Welcome, movie fans, back to another Anatomy of Movie here at the Popcorn Talk Network as we dissect Free Fire. That's right, there's going to be bullets whizzing left and right for the next 90 minutes, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, put your John Denver cassette in. Sit back in your lazy boy and get ready for a good old time with Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans, how are you?
Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And Phil Svitek as we dissect this Ben Wheatley movie. And for those of you who don't know, if this is your first time, first off, welcome. If you're returning, welcome again. We are very spoiler-filled, although there's not much to necessarily spoil in a movie such as this. There's going to be violence and there's going to be gunshots. And that's all I'm going to say. Just for now. As we always do, overall impressions for this movie, starting with me, Marissa Serafini.
Well, I saw the trailer for this film, and I was like, okay, it looks like a fun, ridiculous, kind of easy film to go into. And then watching it, it was exactly that. And I'm glad sometimes simplicity works, and I felt like this movie was super simple. And we'll definitely get into it, but I don't think there was enough like character development for me to care about a lot of these characters. But it was fun seeing like everyone's dynamics and like who hated who and who was on who each other's side. There was a lot of fun dialogue, and the fact that it was in one location, pretty much, it was like this is a very simple film to watch and talk about.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah, listen, writer-director Ben Wheatley. This movie, Free Fire, plays a little bit Reservoir Dogs, a little part Boondock Saints, and maybe even a little bit of Trespass. It's basically 10 minutes of setup where it's a meet and greet of our characters, and then 75 minutes of a shootout. So, yeah, they're all coming together for this gun deal, to make this gun deal. And that deal, as we know, goes south really fast. And then we have this gunfight. And I thought it was hip. I thought it was fun. I never felt that it got self-indulgent with, like, dialogue. And I think that Wheatley and his co-writer Amy Jump, I thought they gave you some characters to root for, even though every single one of them is pretty seedy for the most part. And every character, that's the other thing too, every character has a bullet with their name on it, but with these folks, you got to figure that their names are misspelled. The shooters are trying to figure out who may have double-crossed who and doing whatever. Well, I felt that the safety of a movie theater, like, I sort of figure out who's going to be last person standing. I like the performances. I thought Brie Larson, as the sole female character in this movie, she proves again she can hold her own and stand toe-to-toe with her male counterparts. And I really think that it helped that she was written really well. Like, the character was written really well. So that gave her a lot to do in this, what I agree, this relatively simplistic film. The other person that I really enjoyed watching was Cillian Murphy. He was a lot of fun, too. Armie Hammer pulls in, I thought, a really good performance, and he found, he was suave, but he had this pot-induced swarminess to him. And Charlton Copley, who I usually find to be annoying because he's so over the top and obnoxious, I think he finally found balance in this movie where he turned his obnoxiousness into sort of like ability. Mm-hmm. He's an obnoxious character, but he was funny. Mm-hmm. And we talked about this last week about when an actor can be funny, it sort of gets the audience on his or her side. And he was sort of funny in this movie with his accent and everything. So, yeah, I mean, the movie never overstays its welcome. 85 minutes long. It's over before you know it, which is more than some of the characters in the movie could say.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
Absolutely. And I did like the fact that, to me, it actually had a little bit less action than you might expect. It was nice that we had those moments of character development. We would go forward, then sort of recap, go forward, recap, go forward, recap. But before I fully give my thoughts, Anthony in the booth, in a rare moment, I'm going to throw the mic to him.
Yo.
Because you are a big Ben Wheatley fan.
Yeah,
so
right off the bat, you know, I'm pretty biased. And I mean, I really enjoyed this film. It wasn't bad or anything, so it was really great. I was looking forward to this film ever since I saw a trailer for it months ago. And I gotta say, I was pleased. It's definitely not like a deep movie, but it's very fun. I love the shootout. Like how simple it is, you know, it's just people in a warehouse shooting themselves. And then I love the little like tidbits of dialogue that you can kind of like miss because it gets like lost in the background sometimes. But they're just so funny, like little quippy things, you know. Like Dimitri was telling me about that one, poke him in the eye, see if he's still alive.
Poke him in the eye and see if he flinches.
Yeah, yeah, that was really great. And then like also I guess like the message was like what I think it was the tagline that said it perfectly. Like when everyone has a gun, no one's in control. Mm-hmm. Especially with like our country going through like issues of gun control and like all that. I thought it was pretty cool to make it like this issue of gun control and make it kind of like in a sense campy. I thought it was like a really good take on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what do you like about Ben in general? Because you've seen High Rise, you've seen his other movies. I mean, you went to see it specifically for him, not just because you thought, oh, cool movie.
I did see it for him, but I also saw I like the idea of the movie too. I don't know. It's like that kind of music that just kind of gets you, just touches your soul. He's kind of like the guy who just knows, like he kind of like knows who I am, and like his movies.
I'm frightened in some sense.
You know what? That's he knows who I am.
Like his you movies, relate
like,
to him.
Yeah, his movies definitely speak to me, and I can like relate to his movies a lot. And they just kind of his movies just like get me, you know. Like High Rise was really cool. And also, if you haven't seen The Kill List, it's like I've just seen those two movies, and now this one. And off those, I was just like, I just madly just was in love with his work.
So we just learned that Anthony's a huge John Denver fan.
Oh yeah, from the movie.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you, Anthony. Thank you for sharing. I don't think you ruined your mic time. So
no.
Congratulations there. Yeah, I agree with you guys. I mean, for me, I didn't really have an idea of what this was other than that it was set in Boston. I don't even know why it was necessarily set in Boston. Didn't need to be.
Only thing I can think of is for the accents in the NRA. And there weren't even a lot of Boston accents, but being that this was an NRA...
IRA,
I'm sorry, not NRA. Aren't they the same thing? No, I'm kidding. That's the only thing I can think of, because it's during that time, Irish immigrants in Boston, and it's the only thing I can think of why it might have been set in Boston was for the was for that and the accents.
I mean, it was certainly a selling point for me, so I went because it was set in Boston. and I was sort of duped in that sense, but it was great because the rest of it was fantastic.
And it was filmed in Brighton. Mm-hmm. Brighton, England. Yes. Not Brighton, Boston. When I read, oh, well, it was filmed in Brighton, too. That's not... Oh, England. Okay. But yeah. It looked like Boston.
Yeah, and then, you know, I can't wait to dive into some of this stuff. The fact that, I mean, for the most part, everyone had to interact on the set. Like, you couldn't really be like, okay, you have the day off and we'll shoot you. It was just everyone had to overall be there for most days. So I like that aspect of it. That's that bonding. Why don't we dive into it? Dimitri, you actually have a lot of research in terms of how it got started. Obviously, it's his pet project. Ben writes a lot of his stuff.
Right.
well,
along with, his writing partner, as I said. And
wife. Amy Jump is also his wife.
So, partner. Yeah, wife. and they're good together. And in this, he was basically inspired by real-life transcripts of a 1980s FBI shootout in Miami. And he goes, it was between the FBI and armed robbers, very close quarters, and it went on for ages, 30 to 40 minutes. He goes, the transcript was a forensics report, but it read like a story. And he's like, unless you're like a Navy SEAL and you're trained for this type of gun battle, he goes, what I come to understand is like people who have guns in this situation are actually very terrified deep down, and they're horrible, horrible shots. Which was this movie.
No, I noticed. I was like, wow, everyone is off.
But I like that because typically in a movie, right? Where it's good guy, bad guy, mm-hmm. right? The good guy can, like, mow down 100 bad guys and not use up all his bullets. And the bad guys, like stormtroopers, miss almost every single time. But in this movie, everybody was missing, and it just seemed like if they hit somebody, it was by, well, if you want to call it luck or bad luck, depending on what side of the gun you're on, that's what it seemed like. So, and I think they sort of kind of were making fun of that, too. You know, and hence we get like an 85-minute gunfight.
Yeah.
You know, right? So, and it's funny that he just took it from a two-star and he says, this would be an interesting movie. Like, this is an interesting... let's make this into a story. Let's make it into a movie.
Well, he certainly... I guess he's quite a video game fan, so he's played Counter-Strike and things of that nature. Obviously, that lends itself to being inspired to something.
But on top of that, he's a big Minecraft fan. And so the set, the warehouse, he actually built... in Minecraft. He built his set like brick by brick, so he knew every facet of that warehouse, and he literally had to, because the way the, you know, the way the movie goes along, right, people are constantly changing positions, so he built the warehouse like via using Minecraft to do it, which is funny. But then he had to map out, okay, this person's here, this person's here, this person's up over here,
blocking.
But this person came from over here. He had to, like, from a continuity standpoint, this movie had to have been a nightmare to do. Considering, too, they filmed it mostly chronologically. So, but I just found, since you mentioned video game, yeah, he built the warehouse in Minecraft.
I mean,
but hey, if it did the job,
right?
It's partly a nightmare, partly like the fun thing. You know, one of the things I think they really succeeded at was at no point overall did was I unaware of the spatial relation between everyone, despite them having to move around. So, you know, I attribute acting to that, obviously writing and cinematography, editing, all those things are factors into going, okay, I get where they are.
Mm-hmm.
So. I enjoyed that because I could say for a lot of movies that are even just boiled down to like a 2-minute action sequence, I'm like, what the hell's going on? I'm going to check back in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Because, okay, great, you guys are going to fire, these people die, and our main character's going to go off, and that's the end result, so that's all I need to focus on.
Yeah.
So I rather enjoyed that with this movie that didn't go that route.
It didn't, and I think they used audio cues, so we got to know via accent and voice. Obviously, we know Brie Larson, right?
I'm glad you mentioned that because as we already established our characters within, you know, this room, like eventually you can see throughout probably the second half, you can just hear people's voices off to the side and you know who's who. So,
right.
Like, you do learn people's voices and it's like, is that you, Frank? Is that blah,
right.
blah, blah, blah? And I think because it was so simple that you could easily pick up who's who.
And they did a very smart thing, too, is that, like, they always had people peeking up from cover so we could see them. Hey, you go run over there. I'm not running over there. Like, so the way that it was staged was actually pretty clever in the mere fact, too, that they did it all within 85 minutes and edited this together so that it made sense for the audience in this vast warehouse where Reservoir Dogs, like that warehouse scene, was much smaller. So whatever characters...
And a smaller cast, too.
Yeah. But all the characters you could see in that one setting. This one, well, be it it's not the Raiders of the Lost Ark warehouse, it still had... It had an upstairs, a downstairs. You knew that the phone was upstairs, and that was a goal to get to. So they did a very good job geographically...
Yeah.
For the audience to figure what's what, who's who, and where they are and where they're going.
Yeah, and the 10 minutes in general that we spent early on to that point in terms of giving them voice, you know, I don't think too many people would draw criticism to overspending time initially because that's what allows that. At that point, once the shootout happens, you do know everybody. You know everyone's motives, even if they're just non-existent. In the case of, what's his name, Steve-O.
Steve-O.
you know, But you know each of those people, and so that does allow you to have that. One of the things I found interesting, in fact, was I'd have to go see it back fully to really kind of dissect it even further. But a lot of times I noticed definitely by the middle of the movie, there was dialogue going on, and you weren't on the person at all. Right. You were just seeing kind of the reactions of various things. And very rarely did we go to the actual person talking, unless it was a very specific line that
right.
did move plot forward.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously kudos to them on that because yeah. I think that made it more fun.
I think so too.
Yeah, I mean, we had a short amount of time of development for these characters, but it was long enough to know like what their personalities and right. characteristics were. It was like, oh, Steve-O's an asshole, so he'll probably die. this part, I was like, I like Justine, I hope she lives, you know. It's you got that
Do
short
you like
amount
her now?
Of time. At the end, you know, we'll talk about Justine, but, like, I still like Justine. She was awesome. I think it was more so, like, she was the hen in the doghouse, so, like, I'll give her that.
Well, let me ask, though, like, was it any big surprise that, I mean, for some reason, I don't know why, I just figured she was going to be last person standing, that whatever was going on, she played a part of what this double cross was going to be. And I just sort of had the sense that she would be last, even she technically was last mm-hmm. person standing.
Yeah.
There wasn't a doubt in my mind that she would be one of the last people standing. Did I know that she was part of the double cross? No, I did not.
Well, it was given, like, again, when there was, you know, it's not a big cast, but when Martin... Okay, when Martin comes back to life the second time, that guy was so funny, right? And he's walking and he starts calling out her name. Mm-hmm. Like, you're like, why? They're like, oh my God, it's like her or something. But again, I didn't know what the deal was, what they had. And sort of at the end, Justine goes, yeah, you know, she spills the beans. But what was smart about it, too, is that they set up... You end up liking Cillian Murphy, and you're like... And he's asking her out to dinner, which was funny, but you were like going... They're like, yeah, you know what? We need dinner after this. We'll just meet some... We're shot up really... And I'm like, where the hell in Boston are they going to go have dinner in the shape that they're in? They can go to Southie, and nobody would even look at them twice, you know?
There's so many places.
Yeah. There was that camaraderie, in a sense, that you believed in. And that, to me, is where you had characters to root for, Justine being one of them. I thought Cillian Murphy was one to really like, as well as Chris. And Armie Hammer, because he was... I don't know, I just liked him in this movie, too. You know?
Well, I mean, do you... Like, I didn't find myself necessarily rooting for one character over the other. I mean, to your guys' point, I was rooting for... Cillian Murphy's character.
Chris.
And
Chris.
I thought his name was Ward, but I found out, obviously, at this point that his name is Ord.
Ord.
It's kind of hard to tell Sweden. When there's so many shots being fired. Yeah.
So I liked Ord and Chris overall, but at no point did I say, like, one's better than the other. They both were, at the end of the day... Unlike with anti-hero movies,
right.
I was very... distanced overall with these characters and just had fun watching them in my own sadistic little way of like, can you guys shoot each other up? You guys have fun with this. I just want to know where this goes.
Right.
Right. Agreed. Like, I liked each character for their own like quirks that they brought. I mean, we had Ord, who was, you know, kind of the leader, but he was just, you know, doing the business. He kind of got caught in the middle. But even, you know, Vernon. Like, I kind of liked him because he was just weird, quirky, and also kind of vain, worried about his suit, and then, like, trying to put up that cardboard covering so he doesn't get infected and stuff like that. So, like, everyone had their own personal quirks that is kind of likable, and but, like, you find out, like, Steve-O, like, dude, I'm glad he got the ending that he got, but we'll definitely get into it. But
yeah, I mean, there was
Steve-O. These characters stood out on their own.
But, you know, and it's funny because, like, you mentioned Steve-O was Sam Riley, right? He got the Boston accent down, right, I felt. And yeah, you're right. He was a douche. He was, right?
He was
but there was still something that was sort of funny about him, and I think maybe because it was his Boston accent. But then again, you had Jack Rayner as Harry, who is the guy that recognized Steve-O. The guy with the beard, I believe, right?
Right, and the glasses. Yeah.
And he, too, though, was sort of like... He was
I liked
sort of,
him.
You know, he was like sort of dicky, too. And, you know, but they were like, Harry got shot in the ass.
I mean, in some sense, it's crazy that, that's even somewhat of a statement, because you would say, like, okay, a guy that's, like, basically trying to get blowjobs, even though he has a wife.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this guy's 17-year-old cousin just got beat up because of Steve-O, and we might have a problem with Harry and not Steve-O.
Well, I had a problem with Steve-O. I'm not Steve-O's. Defending Steve-O. You can't defend him. The guy's a jerk.
Yeah.
You know, but...
He was the biggest jerk absolutely. Out of all of them.
But for the most part, most of these people weren't nice people. you know, they're doing a gun deal, and they all have their... them because of their quirks within their character, not mm-hmm. because of their characters, so to speak.
Like,
Copley's an ass, too. You know, I mean, he goes to Brie Larson. He's like, hey, doll, you're looking good, although you gained a few pounds. Fuck off.
But here's the thing, like, in their own weird way, they set up the world really well.
Yes.
And part of it, we're already used to this world, but they had their own set of rules. And I mean, in some sense, it's like a workplace drama, but with guns. You know what I mean? Because, they have their own set of rules. Like, okay, Vernon's taking it. You know, you can consider it like he's taking sexual harassment a little bit too far in the workplace right now. And then Steve-O just completely just did something completely inappropriate. Whereas Vernon was toeing the line, but Steve-O just crossed it.
Yeah.
And so that's what I appreciated about this was that the rules were very clearly laid out. You know, and I enjoyed the whole, like, well, you brought the wrong guns. Well, your boy's a little bit... Whatever, so let's just call it even. Okay, great. Let's figure this out.
Yeah, gun deal or yeah.
So I like that aspect of overall.
But you know, when you talk about you brought the wrong guns, and then you have the Steve-O character. To me, what that helped that helped build like this is like a very quick boil, mm-hmm. okay? Because that was all leading like it was building the suspense in a sense because you had Steve-O. Oh my God, I recognize that guy. Holy shit, I gotta hide. Like, you know, he's gonna nail me. And then, you guys brought the wrong guns. Like, we're not here for these guns. And then you had Charlton Copley, who's, like, insulting, like, Armie Hammer. And you're just, like, going, there's no way this is gonna... Like, there's no way this is gonna go off and work. There's no... Like, everybody is such an idiot. Like, you know...
There's already disconnect between, like, all these characters. You know something is gonna go wrong. What I thought was funny was like how everyone got involved in the gunshots. You know, it started with Steve-O and what's the guy's name?
Harry.
Steve-O and Harry started with them, but like everyone else got like involved like one by one of how they got into it, and I thought that was pretty comedic.
Yeah, and they all got involved like when they like just. Dashed away, and it's like, well, I'm going to side with you. Well, I have cover with you, so, you know. And mm-hmm. and again, Charlton Copley's like, come on, you go ahead and go get the bag. I'm not getting the bag. You're a bird. They're not going to shoot you. And again, it's like, what?
Yeah.
You're the woman. You're fine.
You're fine. No one's going to shoot you. And then she gets up and goes...
Yeah, and that to me was the real key. Like, unlike let's say a typical Western where you literally just have two sides, or perhaps three, because you could consider quote the second round of people coming in the third tier of it. It really was free fire in the sense that everyone had their own different motives.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I mean, as you guys pointed out, Ord is basically an independent contractor, and he's a third party to this. You know, at the end of the day, Harry and the other guy, the Bernie, is it Bernie or Gordon? Too many names.
There's a lot of names.
Basically, Harry's friend that he was hanging out with in the truck, they just want to get paid. You know what I mean? It's not like, as we see, they don't have a loyalty to Vernon one way or the other. Obviously, Brie Larson's the big reveal, and Frank and Chris are tight-knit, but Steve-O is just a rogue gun.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what really worked for it is that, again, it was whenever it was advantageous, okay, I'm going to go with that person. But
right.
overall, I don't have to like you.
Yeah.
If you ain't saved my life, I could care less.
Right. It was also kind of hard once they added the snipers, too. It was like, oh, now we even have more shooters. Like,
right.
Where did they come from? How did they fit in within this group? And I think it was more so because there was such less time developing characters. We were all still learning who's who,
right,
and who's on which side. And then you add more people to it. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, and even they were like, who the hell are the snipers? Like, who's, what are they here for?
And there's, like, I did love their self-awareness because there was a line, like, I forget which side I'm on. And I'm like, so do I.
So do I. And let's talk about the snipers for a second. One of the snipers was played by Patrick Bergen, who is completely, like, unrecognizable to me, just for the proof that getting old sucks. Because you remember that guy, like, he was in, like, Sleeping with the Enemy with Julia Roberts, I believe, you know, who's the villain. Mm-hmm. But I even think he played, in one of the hundredth versions of Robin Hood. He might have been a Robin Hood. But I didn't even know it was him until I was looking at the credits going, oh, my God, that's Patrick Bergen. You know, but the snipers added that, again, I liked it because the snipers just added that element of how the hell else can this thing go wrong?
Well, just I love the fact that they knew Howie and was like, hey, what are you doing here?
Right.
Like, well, I'm just trying to make some money.
Trying to make some money.
So it added that mystery element into it overall. So I thought those elements worked pretty nicely. And as we talked about, like, just, it took its moments really well where it gave each of them a motive in the short term, right? Because obviously, like, the overall motive is just to survive. But it's like, okay, first let's figure out who the snipers are. Okay, we know who the snipers are now. Well, who's involved? Okay, great. Well, now how do we get out of here? Oh, there's a phone here. Okay, go do that. Obviously, and at the same time, still juggling all those things. Like, oh, there's money, there's guns, there's this. But so
right.
It just built on itself, all the while, never letting you forget.
And at the same time, it remained simplistic. Even though as writers, they built up, your clever plot points to move. Like this is a good it's a good screenplay to study for, let's hit our right plot points. Let's add the conflict, like the phone. The phone ringing was like a big deal. Because that changes dynamic. Because mm-hmm. then you have people who are they're going to either call the police, they're going to call for backup, they're going to do something. That's another challenge that our characters have to go through. And other people didn't want people to make it to the phone.
That's like a destination point.
Right. So, yeah, from a screenplay standpoint, it hits its marks, like, really well.
I was most disappointed by Leary. Right?
Really?
That's the guy that comes in.
Because
I definitely want to ask you guys what you thought the order of death was going to be. But in terms of Leary, like, he's sort of at that point represents such hope for however you wanted to find Chris's side, at least certainly for Chris.
Right.
And he just comes in thinking he's the rock star. And because he has none of them could walk at that point. The fact that he could walk is a victory for Chris. And just take it out in a mere matter of seconds, not even a minute.
Yeah, it was
minute.
Like, not even minutes.
I was like, you've got to go into this a little bit smarter, buddy.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, like, you know, he's like Luca Brasi. You know, he's this big henchman that you think is going to take everything. Yeah, he gets taken out really, you know. Yeah, this guy, Tom Davis.
Crowbar, no less.
Yeah. and it's not that he didn't have a good fight doing it. He was like, he was taking out the big man, the hired gun, so to speak. He was the guy that was supposed to come and sweep up. Yeah, he got swept. and he was big, though, too. And, yep.
Oh, he was so big. I expected so much more from him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought he was funny. He was the false hope. I was like, he has no idea what he's getting into. Because there wasn't that slow buildup of, like, them people still shooting at each other. And him, like, slowly getting and walking, getting to mm-hmm. them in that big place. And I'm like, oh, no. He has no idea.
Funny,
though.
What did you guys think the order of death was? And you could start backwards of, okay, who do you think was going to live? And then, build backwards from there.
Well, I knew Steve-O was going to die. I was like, he's the biggest tool. He has to die.
But I didn't expect him to die towards the end. Like, he was one of the last people to die. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, I was
kind of glad he was one of the last people because he was such a big D-bag that I'm glad like he lived to the end, because his death I felt was the most satisfactory death out of everybody.
And it was not by gun.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, really? You couldn't get out of the way of that? But
he got the most gruesome death.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And
rightfully so.
But I do agree with you. Like, I thought while he was the linchpin that, you know, he was the grenade pin that you pull out, right? Yeah. I thought, though, with that, too, he was going to get it. I was like, oh, here we go. There's our first shooting. And then, you know, but he survived a hell of a lot longer than I thought he was going to.
I thought Frank for sure would outlive him, if anything. Nope.
Right.
Nah. I was, you know, I was nervous that Frank would die. Obviously, he did. But, yeah, man, Steve-O definitely outlived poor Frank.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have, like, a... I wasn't thinking in terms of who's going to like a chronology, because again, it did give me characters to root for. So I was sort of hoping that, you know, Justine was going to make it. Ord would have been fun to make, and even Chris. Like the three of them, I thought they'll work well together. Like they're going to make it out, and you know, whatever. So those at least are the people that I was
rooting for. Yeah, same.
So, and then everybody else, I was just wondering how it was all going to play out. And again, not all of them died of gunfire. There was fire, you know, in that movie. Again, Charlton Copley, believe it or not, like that scene, like it was the last scene filmed of the movie. It was one of the scenes that was not filmed in chronological order. The reason being, he wanted to actually be set on fire. And Ben Wheatley's like, oh, well, you know, that might not be a good idea, but if we are going to do it that way, we're going to make sure it's the last scene of the movie, because we don't want you getting hurt at the beginning of the movie or where that scene takes place, so that at least if you get hurt, I like his thinking, at least if he gets hurt, he already did his scenes. We don't need him anymore. But he actually, he lit himself on fire. That guy's crazy.
He is crazy.
In real life, too.
He definitely portrayed that well.
Huh?
Vernon did have, obviously, a ton of great lines, and I enjoyed him quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, unless you guys have any of those story moments or specific scenes that you guys like, I mean, you know, I don't think we need to beat a simple six storyline to death.
Right.
And move on to the production side of things.
I think one of my favorite moments in the movie was when there was literally, like, really no dialogue for maybe 2-3 minutes straight. There was just straight-up shooting, and people are just crawling everywhere. Like, no one's talking to each other. All you can hear is just gunfire.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to figure out, like, where everyone is, like, the blocking of that particular room. But I thought that was done pretty well, because everyone's just trying to move and survive, and no one's talking to each other.
Yeah. And, again, I like scenes, too, that where you asshole, you shot me, and like they had nothing against that person at the beginning of the movie, but because they got hit with a you know unfriendly fire or something.
Yeah, when Harry shot Justine, I was like, oh, that's how she got involved, and
right.
She pulled out her own gun. And I was like, that was friendly fire. And he's like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's like, I'm sorry.
Like, way to go. You shot the wrong person.
It was stuff that's why it was almost. It was a comedy of bad errors or bad manners. So I think that's where the humor comes in with the violence that was...
They're not as good as they think they are, obviously.
Oh, no.
They're terrible.
Yeah. So, did you have a favorite scene or...
It's tough to differentiate overall. I actually, in particular, I liked Vernon overall in terms of everything he was doing. I think looking back on it, Martin was actually quite a lot of fun, simply because now, if you look back on his motives, just the fact that he says that line, like, I'm not dead, I'm just re-strategizing.
Right.
And then he did, that's what he did. And then he got up eventually, you know, 40 minutes later and was re-strategized, unfortunately. He's missing a portion of a brain.
So that's
what a brain looks like. I thought his like revival moment was great though, because he's just like not caring who could shoot him. He was just like out there angry, man. I'm like, oh no, he's on a mission. yeah, I thought his like second revisit was great.
Poke him in the eye and see if he flinches. Who says?
He was like, oh.
What I did love in terms of the process was the fact that Amy Jump was always on set overall, and they actually did a lot of improv, and the more she got to know them, she could write specifically to their voices.
Right.
So it goes back to your earlier point of, yes, there's beats that you want to hit, there's, you know, I'm sure they had dialogue, but now as you're doing it, especially the fact that you can do it in chronological order overall,
right,
sort of lends itself nicely, because you're like, oh, we said that earlier, so now we can really shift it to his voice and use it here. When you shoot out of order, obviously it's a lot tougher to do that.
Could you? And I think from an editing standpoint too, particularly in this movie, to try to shoot it as much in chronological order helps, like, from that process and from a continuity. And I'm not just talking like continuity, like editing continuity. I'm talking from costuming continuity. I'm talking from like where somebody might be talking or pointing. I mean, you got to get, our characters are spread apart in this enclosed environment. It's sort of, it's like a big locked door mystery, because we're trying to figure out who the hell double crossed, who the hell are these snipers, and these people can't get out of here. They can't get out of this warehouse. Like, not one of them thought to run for the door, but if they tried, they were going to get shot, or at least attempted to. So,
absolutely, and you know, it was actually both Ben and Amy that also edited the movie. So I imagine I'd have to dig a little bit further. Unfortunately, you know, with a movie like this, there's not as much information readily available. So I apologize for that. But you know, it's cool to think that Amy could have also been editing as the movie's going on, as she's watching it, help inform what's to come through the writing and so forth. So it's a very fun process in that way.
Absolutely, and to your point too, Wheatley had to make sure every shot, both from a gun and captured by his camera, happened in sync. So what I talked about Minecraft, Wheatley actually drew 1,700 storyboards, built a physical model of the warehouse he planned to film, and even created a 3D simulation of the space in Minecraft. Oh, by the way, is for you science fiction geeks and movie geeks, he used a Blade Runner texture pack to do this, to make sure he got every single shot right. He goes, we could share that amongst all the people who are working on it and walk around inside it together, and he found it useful. But I think that really helps the audience too, because we had a geography. This wasn't a flat warehouse. This is a warehouse that had
levels,
boxes and crates and things to hide in and climb. Yeah,
you know, I love the barrel that the spool, right, if you will, and just using that to like, okay, I'm gonna roll this, or even the dolly. So yeah, all those things to really think of. Okay, how am I gonna move without getting shot?
And line of sight was also very important as well, and that's why he designed, like, using Minecraft, he was able to do a 3D rendering, so and give characters line of sight or not line of sight, and to see whether they can conceivably be hit or not hit. So, there was a lot of work in the details of making this what we think story wise is a very simplistic story. It's a, you know,
well, from what I read, the actors also helped it in the way that they were very cognizant of how many bullets their guns had.
Right.
The only person, and this is ironic and funny, was Steve-O, who just basically just didn't care. He just shot up everything in sight. And in theory, he actually would have ran out of bullets.
They said he would have had to have carried sacks of ammunition, like, with him. But there is actually, and I have it, I just have to go find it, there is actually how many bullets were used and how many shots were done. Just give me 2 seconds. Okay. It appeared reasonable, realistic. How many shots? Obviously, the characters are paranoid. The only person who sucked it up was Sam Riley. To answer your question, I think we fired around 7,000 rounds in just over 6 weeks. Obviously, they're not all in the film. It's an 85-minute film. How much more fat could you have had? We also used around 500 pyrotechnics. They were all practical effects, too. They didn't even add what they do a lot today, too, is CG will add the gun flare. Mm-hmm. No, this is practical effects. You know, this is independent movie, like, to its finest. I think it shows, and it's part of what makes this movie fun, because I think another reason why it's in the 70s, too, is, number one, that's why the telephone is such a big deal. Nobody has a cell phone to whip out.
Exactly.
Okay. Technology is not on their side, because it's not on anybody's side in the 70s. So setting it in a time period where the people can't use technology to get out of a problem, you know. And plus, again, it's bad fashion is always funny.
So. And hair.
And hair. Oh, my goodness.
Some interesting stuff there. A story that Army tells is that, you know, after a couple of weeks of just straight shooting, eventually someone, I guess, did call the police. You're like, well, what's going on here?
We want to know what's funny about that is because where they filmed in Brighton, England, they were using an old newspaper warehouse. And in fact, that newspaper moved into a building like next door. They're the ones that called the police. And they and Ben Wheeling says, yeah, it was the irony of it all is, they're a newspaper. Shouldn't they have known, like, what's going on in their neighborhood? Like,
the news.
But apparently they didn't. So another funny thing is, and this is all in pounds, so I'm sorry that I'm not going to convert it because we've discussed before how I suck at math, but here we go. A blank bullet shot costs around £1. So we didn't have any large caliber weapons, but ammunition for some guns can be £4 per shot. And that's why the movie, you know, that's why war movies, Ben Willey says, are a lot of money to make. I guess, especially if you're filming in England. So he says the budget for the movie was about 5 million quid, but that, I think, relates to about 7 million US dollars.
Yeah.
But a pound a shot.
That's a lot.
That's over a dollar.
For blanks. Yeah, that's a lot. And there were a lot of shots in this movie.
Well, it makes you, again, like the characters, you kind of have to conserve your firepower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that it wasn't just like, okay, wow, they have an infinite supply of bullets. Like, okay, that's
right.
Great. No, it was very much like, okay, I'm going to shoot when strategically necessary.
Right.
Yeah. I think Ord was probably the character that was more cognizant of it, mm-hmm. the most, because like you can see him always checking his mags, going back to get more ammunition.
Yeah.
So he was well aware.
And he seemed to be the most versed, too, because he took out one, if not both, of the snipers.
Mm-hmm.
I think he at least took out one sniper. In trying to figure out where they were, you know, where they were in the building. Ord had that, you know, he was a little bit experienced in this.
Just a little.
Frank, I thought, would be a little bit more experienced, but I think he just got stuck and, he was in no man's land.
Yeah.
And, he was taken out of commission just by his location.
Yeah, I think so.
I thought overall, like, I mean, in terms of the cinematography, I can't praise it enough. Like, it seems so simplistic in that sense, but the fact that at no point are we questioning where we are.
No.
Looks fantastic.
And it was gritty in that 70s type of, like, it had that 70s movie feel to it as well.
Like grunge.
Yeah.
Gross.
And like even the color balance of it. I mean, you had that like the warm yellowish tinted kind of tinged color palette to the whole thing, and you can definitely tell it was one location. Even when they were outside,
right,
when it should be dark, it was still warm colors.
Yeah.
So comedy, for sure. It definitely had a lighter sense to it.
Absolutely.
I would be curious to know, I was going to make this joke earlier, but I would be curious to know if when the police came to them, if they were like, hey, can we use you for the shot at the end of the movie? The sirens? And save some money that way?
It happens.
That'd be, yeah. Okay. A happy accident. It could have been them.
Listen, if you're an independent filmmaker, trust me, that's how you're thinking. You're while you're here, let's make it worth your time.
Yeah. Save some money, too.
And that would explain, you know, Brie Larson's, like, look on her face going, who the hell? What?
Did they just ruin the shot? Yeah. Could be completely different. Speaking of Brie Larson, one of the things that she talked about heavily was character motivation and building backstory. And, you know, for a movie like this, she didn't speak about everyone else, but the fact that, you know, she created her own backstory. And that's what makes these characters rich. I mean, you sort of know everyone has a backstory. Vern, in particular, holds his out the most and tells it to people. Like, I'm from South Africa.
Yeah, I'm like, in South Africa. I'm into fashion. Yeah.
It's like, what's his accent? I don't know.
So I love that, you know, and I think each of them did actually spend, if I had to guess, a good enough time to on their backstory to make it work, because at no point does it feel like that they're just empty people that are just spinning out this dialogue.
Right.
I don't care how good you are, if you don't know your backstory in a movie like this, it's going to show.
Yeah. And she had, not only did she have, like, doing that as an actor, coming up with her backstory or what she believed she was going to be, she also had this funny thing, too, about her costuming. Because, you know, she was like, you know, she believed that Justine really didn't have any money. Or, you know, she either borrowed or stole. Like, she didn't wear anything flashy. But the one thing that she said is that she was in those, like, 70s kind of heels kind of thing. And she thought that that would be good for the character. But after about a few days of shooting, she was like, they were killing me. She goes, I went to Ben going, we got to do something. He's like, you know, like, give it just a few more days, because it's all going to change.
Yeah, because you're going to be crawling the rest of the movie.
Crawling.
You'll be fine.
And then after she was crawling for a week, she's like, can I go back to standing? She goes, that was easier. But she said, too, though, that they had to have, like, two costumes. And one of the costumes had to be a little bit bulkier so that they can put – they were allowed to wear pads underneath to make the crawling
on
easier.
Rocks.
Yeah, the crawling on concrete and shrapnel and rocks. And
I mean, by the end, it was in some sense it was hard to watch, because it was like, can anybody get up?
Yeah, like there's literally during the time where like that 2-3 minutes when everyone's just crawling, there's like literally no one is standing right now.
Talk about the world's slowest chase scene.
And like again, you say the world's slowest chase scene. That's the way, like, the way Steve-O dies. Like, that van was, like,
that was
just a neutral.
It's like, he couldn't get
out of the way of a van in neutral that wasn't really on an incline.
Yeah. Absolutely ridiculous. But in the best of ways. In the best of ways.
Oh, that sound effect, though. My God. I was like, oh, that's horrible.
And then, I mean, they did not shy away from that shot overall. It was we're going to show this to you. It's going to be like a wheel over a melon.
Yeah.
In slow motion, you can see every frame of this.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness.
So the other thing, too,
it's
I
quite
give
rewarding.
Brie Larson credit for, and actually Ben Wheatley was asked, too, about what's it like working with big actors. And he says, well, she definitely wasn't in King Kong yet. She had finished The Room, but hadn't won the Academy Award yet. So he got her, you know, at a good time. Now, that's not saying with Brie Larson as a person and her makeup that she wouldn't have chosen this project maybe a little bit after she had won the Academy Award. But, you know, she gave her all. She was there. And
well, Cillian Murphy, I mean
he's done a ton.
I mean, he's basically Christopher Nolan's boy. I mean, he's in Dunkirk coming up. So it's not like, you know, he's not known. Armie Hammer, obviously.
Charlton Copley's been in.
Charlton Copley's been in a lot.
A few movies too. So.
And I think they just had to. It just seemed like they had a good time with it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if you're a guy, I don't care what they're. Wouldn't you want to be like, hey, I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm in.
Sure.
We're fighting for. You know, it's a 90-minute movie about just us fighting, and I get to shoot that. Great. I'm in.
And Brie was asked, too, like, Because, again, at the time, prior to filming King Kong, I mean, this is this seems to be a good question, was about, was there a learning curve on explosions? And her answer was, yeah, not being scared of them, just kind of trusting. She goes, it's a very odd thing that someone tapes a little explosive onto your body, then 5 minutes later, they're like, all right, on the count of three, this thing's going to explode. And you're like, really? How do I know it's going to explode the right way? You know, and you're right. I think this film built a camaraderie amongst its talent and its crew, where they, you know, you have a line like that, and that's funny. It's like, really? Is this thing going to go off the right way? And so I did get a sense that people were having at least fun making this movie.
I think so.
You know.
I think so. I would venture to say yes.
Yeah. So the other thing, too, that did not escape me was Martin Scorsese has a credit.
He helped produce
this. Yeah. He gets an executive producer credit. He read the script. He sent back notes. And they said that basically was pretty much it. But his name, you know, it's interesting. I'm sure he got paid to get his name on the credits. He obviously saw something in it. So it was outside of a paycheck, obviously from his roots, you know, doing small independent violent movies. Obviously, he saw something that he liked. But it's not uncommon for a studio, if they're fortunate enough, and you're able to get a name to put on there, you use it as a marketing tool. But for some reason, like, it only came in the credits. Like, I didn't see it really on the poster at all. Was it on the poster? Did I miss it?
No, it's not on the poster. It's only, you know, in the credits.
Because sometimes the studio, look, when I was at Lionsgate, go ahead.
Well, no, yeah, because I think a couple years ago we talked about there was, you know, even a worse example of there was that Jesse Eisenberg movie, and I think he was in the movie for like 1 minute, and they put him on the poster as if he's the lead of the movie, and he's like, "What the hell? You can't do that."
Well, in this sense, obviously
a different story,
right? Well, but Lionsgate, when we were releasing Eli Roth's Hostel, Eli Roth, Quentin Tarantino were good friends. Getting Quentin Tarantino's name onto a poster that said something to the effect of Quentin Tarantino presents Eli Roth's Hostel, having his name on the poster really did help, because it appealed to his fans and then to horror fans.
So many people saw Hostel.
Right, and Hostel too. And he really didn't have anything to do with the movie per se. And There are a good handful of Wes Craven Presents movies in which there are a horror movie. He had nothing to do with them, but he got his name on it. There was a time when, from a studio, you would put a person's name as a producer on that poster and in the trailer, because people would associate, oh, I see Wes Craven's name. That's the guy that did Nightmare on Elm Street. This guy knows horror. You know, he did Scream.
He's got the fan base.
Yeah, he's got the fan base. They might go see his movies.
But, I mean, to that point, I mean, the fact that he's even read the script and sent back any notes, like, he didn't necessarily have to do that. He could have gotten just a check and, okay, slap your name on it.
Right.
So,
I think this says a lot about him, too, because, I mean, you know, Martin Scorsese and The Departed and whatnot, I feel like this is definitely his genre and his demographic that would like this film as well.
Yeah, and, you know, he says, Ben Wheatley was saying, towards the end of the process, they did send him an edit, and he got to talk with Scorsese about it. And he goes, listen, he was very supportive. He was gentle. He goes, but his name helped secure us a lot of financing. And his name, in this case, instead of using it for marketing, his name was used to get financing and to get talent involved. This is a more, again, when you're going to talent and going, hey, this is a Martin Scorsese produced film. Oh, I want to be in a Martin Scorsese produced film. Mm-hmm. So it just seemed that it was used on the opposite side of the spectrum, because it wasn't thrown in as a marketing ploy to get an audience in. But if you're trying to secure financing through banks or whatever, you say Martin Scorsese, and it's a crime drama that you're filming, that says a lot, that he's going to support you. And they said he was very supportive of it.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the movie's been overall completed for a little bit at least. It was at the Toronto International Film Festival back in October of 2016.
Right.
Or, sorry, that's October 16th was the London Film Festival, but TIFF was even before that. So it's been out for a little bit, and you know, did the circuit in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wish it had a little bit more legs in terms of the box office now. But yeah, I think I would like to see a little bit more promotion behind it, and I'm curious why they haven't utilized Scorsese for that side of it.
Yeah, I don't know, and it might have been in his contract where he said something. I don't want to be. You know, he might have said, "Listen, I'm in the credits." Use me to help you get the film made. I don't want you to use my name to help get the film marketed or promoted. Mm-hmm. Now, what was most surprising to me about when we're talking about the marketing of this film, this was actually distributed by an indie company that I've talked about many times before because I'm a huge fan. It's A24.
Yeah.
A24 is, well, they've given us things like Ex Machina, they've given us some really solid, very solid independent movies. And what makes, because they've had that great balance of they're going to put out a good movie, but they have really solid marketing behind it. For me, I was a little bit disappointed because I actually felt that the marketing for this movie, particularly the movie poster, it wasn't, I didn't like it. It didn't grab me. And they did an alternate movie poster that was so 70s style, and I'm like, why didn't you go with that? Well, like, who picked the one with all of the characters
in a circle
and the guns, and not one where they had all of the characters that were drawn the way they used to make 70s, you know, the posters in the 70s. I was like, why didn't you go with that one? Because that one definitely is eye-catching. It would draw me in a little more.
Well, it's the same reason back then. To me, I think, remember back in the day of Hollywood when people started using close-ups and execs were like, when people go to see the movies, they want to see the person, they want to see the actor, not right. just the face, they want to see the whole
yeah.
person.
Yeah.
So in this sense, right. I don't know, I would venture to say that it's because, like, well, why would they want to see a cartoon version of Brie Larson when they could see Brie Larson on the poster?
Yeah, but they didn't even utilize it. Like see how this is like 70-esque and they're on a record? Like, to me, that captures a better feel for what this movie is.
Yeah, it's actually a target. Sorry.
I'm sorry, say that again.
It's
a target?
Yeah, from target. Where it's, yeah.
My glasses suck. I'm sorry. but yeah, I think that it's really, you know, I don't know. I think this movie, they didn't market it as well
as they could have,
and that we know that they can do, because they've really... They've turned the independent distribution thing sort of kind of on its heels, and they've come up with solid quality, even nomination-worthy performances and some movies. And this one, I don't know, it just seemed to be a little bit of a misstep.
To be fair, I mean, I don't know if this necessarily accounts for it, but they sort of came into the game a little bit later.
Sure.
At this point, it's been about a year since they got the rights to this movie. But at the same time, you know, they weren't the original distributor.
Yeah.
So, you know, that could play into it.
Yeah.
Right. And also, I think that the time of the release of the film, too, it's already limited. And I feel like it's one of those movies that they just plopped in the middle of big releases of other mm-hmm. movies. And because we know this filmed at Toronto, so that was already like September of last year, of 2016. So months have passed. Had they released it before, you would have had before the Oscar season, and then now it's after Oscar season, where the random movies are just placed. So I don't think timing on this film works for them either.
Yeah, and I think with whatever budget that they were given to market, you know, I mean, it opened up at a hair over 1,000 locations. I believe 1,070 locations. And we were talking about this earlier. It wasn't playing at the theater near me,
Norman,
which usually plays everything, okay? So I had to go, you know, I had to go to another theater, not too far away. I'm not complaining, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't as easily accessible as I thought it was going to be for this movie. I didn't see the trailer a ton, and there wasn't a lot of buzz. And to your point, it's release time. I believe some of the actors are promoting other things, or they're onto other projects. Like, I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, because it helped to find a nice Brie Larson interview. So she obviously supported the film. They all went to, I believe, the premiere was in New York City, and they all had some great shots and pictures of the, you know, the cast and crew. Ben Wheatley obviously wants the movie to work, and he has a bit of a cachet, as Anthony has proven out, has proven to us. So he talked, you know, he talked up the film, I think, more than a lot of other people, you know, might have been available to talk up the film. You know, Cillian Murphy, you said Dunkirk.
Yeah, it's coming up real fast.
It is. So,
I agree. And, I mean, it has a 67, last time I checked on Rotten Tomatoes, 67% audience score. So, not too, obviously, right there. I'm surprised more people, audience-wise, don't necessarily like it. I think what's fun is it's not a just turn your brain off action movie, but at the same time, it's not like you have to do too much thinking. And it's just fun. It's visceral. Just enjoy it.
But, you know, to a point you made earlier, and I think it's important to our conversation, Phil, is that you had said something, we were talking, it's not the movie I expected it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You go see a movie like this, it's not that I've said this before about other movies, but we go to movies. That's what we do. We go to movies. We talk movies. If it's not the movie you're expecting it to be, think about the audience that doesn't really know what the movie is and whether or not they're going to be willing to plunk down money to go see it. And again, that's a little bit of a misfire, I think, on marketing, because people couldn't get a handle as to what is this movie going to be. And maybe if they came out, maybe they too thought it was going to be a different kind of a movie. I mean, I don't know, but 66% Rotten Tomatoes isn't horrible, no. Particularly of a movie of this ilk. With a $7 million budget, I can't fathom that the budget was much more when it came to distributing the film and marketing materials. Maybe it was 15 to 20 all in. And 20 is on the very high side. But when you have an opening weekend of, on 1,000 locations, and your opening weekend is not even $1 million, the movie itself right now is almost at $1.5 million. So unfortunately, it just doesn't seem that word of mouth outside of us and maybe other the 67% of people who liked it, you just got to go out and tell people that, hey, this movie is a lot of fun.
Plus, it's limited too, so not the whole country is not able to see this.
It's not next door, but there have been other movies that opened up in 1,000 locations that do pretty well. There's like good buzz about it, but this movie, it deserved a little bit better fate. And you're right, maybe had they chosen not to come out the second week, or what was it, the third week of Fast and Furious? No, I think it was the second.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fate of the Furious?
Just came out last week.
That's tough, because it's still a big giant wave out there that's sucking up,
Good business. Luck trying to get anything in the coming, Like, summer is now basically 8 months.
It is.
Yeah.
But
like, we're at the beginning of all the summer movies now, so.
Yeah, it starts in April now.
So what was the movie in March? We had a March movie.
Beauty and the Beast.
There you go.
Beauty and the Beast was the huge one in March.
Crossed a billion.
So. Yeah. But if you maybe release this in January, maybe February.
Maybe, yeah.
Stay away for, I don't know, maybe do it on Valentine's Day as a opposite. But, you're right. It's funny that summer would start on Mother's Day, which I think it was Universal who released like the first Brendan Fraser Mummy on that day. And people thought, oh, that's really early because we have 2 more weeks until Memorial Day. That's the kickoff of summer. And now summer's starting in March, April. you know, that's when we've gotten like Captain America movies and things like that. So
right. Yeah, last year it was in March, Batman v Superman.
Right. Now we're going into and then
the
like
comic movies.
Yeah, September, October. October looks like it's going to be a big month. So this is good for the movie going fan. Maybe not so good for this smaller type movie. The industry people talk about this that the middle movie is sadly like going away. I don't want to see it go away because this is definitely a middle movie. It's worth seeing, you know. I mean, and it is to a particular taste. It's sort of kind of like, and I don't know if the data is available, but I'd like to know what Reservoir Dogs opened up at, because that movie for sure. Nobody knew Quentin Tarantino. It's even more violent than this movie is. Let's see if I can find...
But it was like, was that as accessible back then as this one is now? And plus, you know, internet has changed the way that people watch movie. Like, so that was more than 10 years ago.
I mean, ask yourself how many superhero movies were out when Reservoir Dogs
exactly.
came out.
Like, just well, the way people ingest movies now is so much and different than Reservoir Dogs back
it's
then.
Opening weekend. Well, let me give you a... Let's give you an idea. It's opening weekend, which, by the way, was October 23rd of 1992.
Exactly.
Completely different type of distribution. But catch this. 19 theaters it opened up at. 19 on its opening weekend. And it did $147,839,000, okay, on its opening weekend. Its domestic total thus far is only $2.8 million. Now, they tracked and got grosses, and they distributed movies. It was a Miramax film, much different than they did and that they do today. Its production budget was $1.2 million. At the time, okay, 1992. So, but when you're looking at, I'm trying to find out like what its widest, what its widest theater chain. That movie at its tops was at 61 locations, tops. Okay, and that movie ended up grossing $2 million. Now, why? Because it opened up in October. Stayed pretty much through December in 1992. You know, I don't know if this movie's not going to stay around for 3 months.
Oh, no.
If it stays around for 3 weeks, you know, they'll be fortunate. And they might, if they're going to be at $1.5 million, they might peak $2 million at the end of the day. So.
Possibly.
Maybe.
So, if you love this movie, the message is go support it, tell your other friends. I mean, the nice part is this is definitely a movie that you can rewatch,
yeah,
if you love it.
Yeah. Actually, today I read they announced the Blu-ray deal, which I think is going to be sometime in August.
Okay.
So, you know.
Quite a ways away, but yeah. Sure.
Yeah. But go see it in the theater. It sounded good, you know. As an audience member, I felt safe, but the bullets were whizzing over my head.
No, I think the first moment when I was like, oh, man, was when they first got the rifles and he was testing it out for the first time, and all you could hear was, like, the loud gunshots.
Right.
So I was like, oh, no, this whole movie's going to be like this. And but it sounded great, like
yeah, it
was
did.
Saying.
Yeah. Who was – okay, so we figured out that Steve-O probably had the most violent death. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yes,
no?
For sure.
Okay. Who was – I mean, Charlton Copley's character – pretty much had a... I mean, he got burnt to a crisp. I mean, he made, you know, bacon look bad. Like, that was, like, overly cooked bacon. And then he got shot in the face. He got shot in the nose.
That was a headshot.
Yeah.
That was a good headshot.
Yeah. I would say our characters towards the end definitely died the more gruesome.
Yeah.
I do have to applaud Justine, though, for making it until the end. Like, granted, she double-crossed all of
let's
them.
Let's clap for the bird.
But, yes, let's clap for the hen in the doghouse. But it was more so, like, just woman supporting another woman. I was like, yeah, you go, girl. Especially standing up against all those men. I liked it. And the fact that, like, they built her up like she was the most likable character.
Yeah.
I mean, she cared about other people, and she was part of this business and this whole deal. And
she was playing all of them.
Yeah, she was.
I actually felt bad.
But that's where the twist was, because she she was playing the likable character. You're like, you're rooting for her because she is so nice. You don't want her to die.
No.
So I think they did a good job with
her. I didn't want Cillian Murphy to die either. I didn't want Orr to die. Like, I was like, did she have to kill them? Like, what? Like,
yeah, she did in her mind.
Yeah. Survival of the fittest.
Yeah, Chris
Final thoughts. Final thoughts of Free Fire.
It was a fun movie. I like simplicity. Every once in a while you have to watch like one of these fun movies. It's popcorn talk, sure, and a popcorn type of movie. I'd like to see this, if this was possible, being translated to stage, because it's all in one location. I mean, granted, there's a lot of gunfire, but because of the dialogue is so conversational and simplistic, I think it'd be interesting if it was translated to
stage. Find out on our Popcorn Talk Show Broadway Breakdown.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. See how that translates.
Just kidding. I doubt that they would.
But
other
than that, it was a fun movie.
Fair enough.
It had all the fun, cool hipness without any pretentiousness. This movie was not pretentious. You know, it played really well. It plays very fast.
Yeah.
You know, it's 85 minutes. I mean, it felt like the trailers were going to outplay the movie at a time at the theater that I watched it at. So, I had a really good time, and I enjoyed some of the performances a lot, too. So, it's a good time.
Yeah. If first the few fans that watch us without seeing the movies, definitely a movie that I recommend, worth seeing. It has our stamp of approval, so go check it out.
And speaking of fans, did you know new ratings books came out? We're number one in Quebec, in Montreal, yeah, in Quebec. In Quebec. We're number one in Quebec, Canada. That's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Think.
Yeah.
So in Canada.
We're Germany, Sweden, Quebec. I believe we also have some viewers in Montreal that have made us number one in Montreal. And Minnesota. Minnesota, of all places.
It's so cold there. That's what fantastic. Else you got besides the movies?
and
Minnesota.
Easy, but
we're no longer number one in Minnesota.
Who happens to be our number one fan in Minnesota, because always watches our stuff. But hey, we're like we said, one frame at a time, we're taking over the world.
There you go.
Like yay, Canada.
Yeah.
So,
love Canada.
Let us know your thoughts. Let us know your opinions. Obviously, we enjoyed the movie. Who was your favorite character? What was your favorite scene? Too much violence, too little violence. Is this your first Ben Wheatley movie? All those things. Whatever you want. That's what the comments are for. We love talking with you guys, hearing your guys' opinions, because ultimately we can't get through everything. And that's what makes this a great community. So, until next time, thank you guys for watching at The Popcorn Talk, at DMovie1701.
Thank you.
At Serafini TV.
That's right.
And check out all of our other past anatomies. Check out our future anatomies, right? We've been mentioning Dunkirk, so that's definitely coming up.
Guardians is coming up.
We did King
Baby
Kong.
Driver. We did King Kong with Brie Larson. We did Room with yeah,
right.
We had that was a great one,
that's
too.
A great one.
That was
we've
a really
got,
good one.
In our library, we've got quite an extensive library of over 350 movies already dissected, and plenty more to come. So keep checking back in. Thanks for watching. Bye.
Bye.
We would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.